When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
When this episode is available to the world, that means my book, The Inscrutable Dr. Bear and the Case of the Two-Faced Statue, is also available to the world at long last. It's finally out in stores. You can get it by going to drbear.com, drbear.com. You can also do a search on any place where you get books. And if you're just tuning in and you're not familiar with this book, let me give you the premise, because this leads into the interview that I'm about to share as a way of celebrating the book's release into the world. Dr. Bear, it's a spooky middle grade fantasy adventure graphic novel, and it's with cute, adorable little animals and spooky monsters and some thrilling adventures and some physical peril and also a lot of what I think is timely exploration of emotional growth when one realizes that the world that they have been living in and taking for granted is only a piece of the larger puzzle of existence amongst all these different kinds of people with different backgrounds. Now, what do I mean? He's a scholar. He lives in a spooky house with all these little cute, spooky creatures. And adventurers bring him their dangerous treasures. And the example I always use is your Perseus. You use the Gorgon head. You stop the Kraken. Good for you. What do you do with the Gorgon head afterwards? Now, I know that something came of it in the actual mythology. But as a kid, what I got stuck on is like, well, if he takes it home and puts it in his closet, what if his kid finds it? You know, I go rooting around in my parents' closet sometimes looking to see if I can find some hidden Christmas presents. What if I found a Gorgon head? That kind of thing. So Dr. Bear's the guy that adventurers take those things to, and he carefully catalogs them, he decurses them, and they live happily in his spooky house. And it took me a long time to figure out this premise. And I remember I was in a grocery store and I had my shoulder bag with my sketchbook in it, and the idea landed on me as like, oh, cursed objects aren't this, they're actually that. And I hastily wrote it down. And it all revolved around this idea, because I don't want to spoil it in case you're actually going to go out and get the book. It all revolved around this idea of Dr. Bear's been telling their story, and there's another story that he is not privy to because he hasn't been paying attention. And I'm fortunate enough to be married to a woman who works in museums, which means I have a lot of, I'm very adjacent to a lot of discussions that are happening in the world of museums. And either through the conversations with them, or maybe one of them noticed, it's been so long now I don't remember, but the idea emerged of like, oh, this is kind of like, it's very harmonious with conversations around object and cultural repatriation, which we'll learn more about in the discussion. Now, I'm not an expert on this subject, and I haven't been privy to a lot of the conversations on this subject, so unlike my hero, Dr. Bear, I thought I should sit down and listen to some people instead of coming to my own conclusions on it and find out, like, what are the conversations happening around this and what the concept of object repatriation became sort of like a guiding theme in the book. I wouldn't say the book's about that, but the ideas and energy and intent surrounding that topic became inspiration for a lot of the ideas that happened in the book. So my friend Marisa Spiteman, who is a museum professional, was gracious enough years ago to sit down with me for an hour and talk through a lot of these ideas with me before I started writing the book. And she came back, now that the book is out, to have another conversation with me to sort of do a victory lap around this topic. And so we could explore some of those ideas in a more public setting. For people who are interested in the book, you can find out, like, what was the conversation we had around this and how might this help underline some of the ideas that I was playing with in The Inscrutable Dr. Bear and the Case of the Two-Faced Statue. Now, there might be some mild spoilers as we explore these ideas, so I'll warn you. You might, if you're really spoiler-averse, you can go get the book at drbear.com and then come back and listen to the conversation. But like I said, they're mild spoilers, I think. But in any case, here's the conversation with my friend Marisa.
Okay, so hello, Marisa.
Hello, Jersey.
Hey, my old friend Marisa. Gosh, we've known each other for more than a decade now.
It's been something like 15 years, I think.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And you're one of the interesting stars in my network in that I feel like you and I have a lot of shared interests, but our careers are very different.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if you could just introduce the people who are listening to this, what your job is and what that means before we dive into the topics.
Oh, definitely. So I work as a museum registrar at a large art museum in the Metro Detroit area. And my job is registration, like collection specialist. So I work with objects to bring them into the building. I do a lot of shipping logistics. I also work with source communities that the museum has acquired objects. You know, it's been around for over 100 years. So we've acquired a lot of objects from many different communities over the last century. And I work with those communities to get information on their cultural heritage items, to work with them to, you know, learn about their pieces from them, because a lot of people who are active in their communities are either making art, they are using those objects as teaching tools to pass on knowledge to future generations. And so I help run consultations with those groups to bring them into the museum so they can see their pieces and work with them. I'm also involved in repatriating objects. So objects that are deemed important to a community or a group, either in a cultural heritage sense or as cultural patrimony. I work with those groups to send those objects back to their communities. So it's really diverse work, but it's really, really rewarding.
Well, I was going to say this, there's a lot of jargon in there that I know now because I'm married to a museum professional. But I did in 2006 co-author like a 200 something on page graphic novel called The Replacements, where one of the people, one of the main characters was a registrar in a museum. And I remember my editor on the book actually said
I think I remember this. Yes.
Yeah, it's a very old book. But yeah, my editor on the book was like, I had no idea what a preparator was before I read this, or what a provenance file was. And I was like, well, yeah, it's like, this is all stuff that I sort of got through osmosis being so adjacent to the museum world. But I want to talk a little bit about your interests, too, because I feel like your interests as a human being are fueling a lot of what your job is, too, because you really, really love Egyptology and always have.
I do. Yes. And I really love Egyptology. And that's what I studied in school. I studied Egyptology and archives and records management. So what I do now in my work sort of combines both of those things.
And I mean, if anybody hasn't figured it out yet, one of the reasons I asked you to be here is that those interests of yours figure largely into ideas that are in my book, The Inscrutable Dr. Bear and the Case of the Two Faced Statue, because we're talking about ancient artifacts with stories that scholars have to deduce, infer, and corroborate with other authors, but then also with the cultures from which the objects came, right?
Right.
So,
right.
And that's my way of segueing into, I remember when I first came up with the idea of, and so for those, like, the book is out now at the time of when this podcast is released, and the log line is Dr. Bear is the guy in the fantasy world that Perseus can take the Gorgon head to and have it safely stored, right?
So he
stops the Kraken. What do you do with the Gorgon head? You put it in your closet. What if your kid finds it? Well, Dr. Bear's the guy you could take it to, and he'll find a safe way to keep it. And on top of it, the spirit that's in it will be pacified and kept happy in his, you know, spooky house. Which means he's sitting on this stockpile of magical weapons of mass destruction, which means every wizard in the world wants in his house, which means one gets in, all the objects get out. He goes out in quest of them to get them back, only to find out they're not cursed objects. They're something else. We don't have to say what they are, but there's something that it's not a cursed object, and he has to deal with that realization. So I remember when I came up with the idea of like, oh, cursed objects are really this. And I remember telling you that. And you, I have it right here in my hand, Marisa.
Oh my goodness. It's our original note. I can't believe you kept that.
Of course I did.
That was years ago.
This was a long time ago. And you were very excited. You said, because I said to you, I was like, well, I haven't figured out what the cursed objects in the story are going to be yet, because there's going to be like two or three main ones that our hero has to track down in order to uncover the mystery, and then the implication will be that he goes and does that for all the other objects. But it's, are you ready for me to read the list?
Yes, I'm ready for you to read the list.
I swear to God, it was like 2 minutes later, you handed me this card, and it had all this stuff on it. King Tut Falcon, cursed items, canopic jars, animal mummies, amulets, so falcob, scarab, ring, and ankh, Anubis statue sitting, you put in parentheses, sitting, yeah. Has to be sitting.
Very specific, though. It's the sitting one, not the standing one.
Well, we can go into the reason, what's the difference between the two in a minute. We got King Tut statues, King Tut riding a panther, that's specific.
Oh, yep, very famous piece.
A seated lion. Okay, now I don't know how to pronounce this. It's Ureaus. Is it Ureus?
That's the Ureus, yes. Yeah. It's a protective snake and like vulture that would sit on the top of the king's crown.
And, yeah, you actually have here in parentheses snake and vulture. That's great.
Yeah.
You got Selket, scorpion goddess.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I'm not sure. Sobele, crocodile god?
Oh, Sobek?
Sobek, that's a K.
Sobek,
okay.
The crocodile god.
And this one,
there are great crocodile mummies in Egypt, like really spectacular giant crocodiles. They're beautiful.
And I mean, and for anybody who is like followed my work for a long time, especially my podcast, the way I talk about Transformers is the way Marisa will talk about Egyptology. It's like she'll take a deep breath and then 7 minutes later you're still listening. This one I actually used in the book, a mummy head with a cranium hinged. And I thought, that's a really interesting idea.
That's a really interesting, and I'm going to say person, because it is a person. It's a person's head.
Okay.
That was turned into an object sometime in the 1800s. This is actually a real piece that's at the museum that I work at.
Oh, wow.
And it sort of encapsulates everything that I find fascinating about the history of Egyptology and museums too, in general, because the field, especially in the early days, really pursued scientific inquiry, and within the sort of, you know, umbrella of colonialism. And it did that in detriment to the humanity of the people who created these objects, and in a lot of cases detrimental to the humanity of the people themselves, because when we go to museums, you know, if there's a mummy at the museum, everybody wants to see the mummy, but sometimes I think people forget that that's a person there that we're looking at, and they lived their entire life. They had families, they had a job, they had pets, they had people who loved them and people that they loved. And that's divorced from their entire context. Their whole life is gone to us, and what we have is them. So it's a very powerful connection when you realize that what you're looking at is a person there. And the head in particular, that's a person's head. He has his hair still. You can see all of his features really clearly, and he was turned into an object by someone. His cranium was cut open, and there was a hinge put on the back so you could open the skull. And that the dehumanization is really striking in that moment, because you realize that somebody in the history of their own life bought this person as like a curiosity when they were on a vacation, probably. And as a museum professional nowadays, remembering that we have to give this person their dignity back, even in the situation that they find themselves in now. There's no way that we can reconnect them to their body. There's no way that we can necessarily give them the burial that they deserve, but we have to give them their dignity back and their humanity back.
Yeah. So this is the kind of conversations I remember having with you years ago that informed the book, because in this scene of the book is actually like in the preview pages on drbear.com. So I'm not spoiling anything with this, but I remember in the early drafts when I was sharing the outline with you, there's this whole negotiation between these two adventurers and Dr. Bear over a werewolf head. And it's a hinged werewolf head. And Fleet of Boulder and Fleet is like, okay, how much money are we talking about here? I got this werewolf head. It's got a curse on it that makes people into werewolves. How much money will you give me for it? And you wrote in the margins of the notes, you're like, they're bartering over or bickering over the price of a human remain or like a person's remains, right? You're like, this is potentially troubling. And I remember that when I got that note, I was like, that's exactly what I want. I want the cuteness of this story to be held in stark juxtaposition of that notion of, yes, he's helping, but there's something kind of questionable about the entire assumption that's happening here. There's a big assumption, and there's something
right
about,
a huge assumption, yeah,
and it, an exotifying of something, right? Like, it's okay if this person's humanity is stripped away. If it's an exotic item, we'll turn it into a lidded, a keepsake.
It's right, something that becomes a, conversation starter in somebody's house,
I'm not laughing the good way, I'm laughing the bad way.
No, it's so ghoulish, it really is.
It is.
It really is. Yeah.
So, right there, like that moment when you're telling that story, and when we would hang out and you would tell me these kinds of like stories from work, it was like that's where the beginning of Dr. Bear kind of began for me, was like that, like coming to grips with how, because I mean, growing up in the culture I grew up in and breathing the air that I was breathing, I didn't question it. Right? Things that came from other lands were mysterious and weird and encoded and enshrouded in some kind of mystery. And that's the way I liked it, right?
Well, and two, I think thinking about that list that we talked about, when King Tut's tomb was opened in the 1920s, there was a lot of, the tomb is cursed. This was written up in all the newspapers. There wasn't, to my remembrance, actually a curse on Tut's tomb. There are other tombs in Egypt that have curses on them, and they were to deter people from, disturbing the person who was resting there. And, the tomb landscape in Egypt was really active. People would go and spend time with their relatives. There were special feast days set aside where you would, visit with your deceased loved ones. And also tombs were robbed in antiquity because of all the, gold and jewelry and really high quality objects that were buried in there. And that was sort of to deter, curses were specific spells that were to deter people from breaking and entering into a tomb in antiquity. And I think the exoticism of Egypt, and especially in the 1920s when Tut's tomb was opened and all this beautiful stuff was coming out of it, the only intact tomb that's ever been found in Egypt, it really captured the public's imagination in a really specific way. And then there were certain deaths that were sort of associated with King Tut's tomb, had nothing to do with any curses, it was just bad luck. But that kind of how it gets embedded in the public imagination, and then trickling down into modern times when we have mummy movies and novels written where sort of this idea of curses and reanimating mummies sort of meets in popular culture, right? So there's the history goes way, way back.
And I mean, and the part that I find fascinating is that when you say all that, I feel like it kind of resides in the same psychic space as like a fairy tale, where it's using a symbolic and encoded language to alert us to the fact of, dude, you're desecrating a grave. That was a person's life that you're just like saying like, hey, look at this guy's stuff, right?
Right.
Let's pray it around the world, right? But it doesn't.
All the stuff that this person needed to get to the afterlife,
right.
You know, in a very specific way. Like, it wasn't just, oh, we're burying things to put in there. There were specific reasons for that. And yeah, it's so, what you said about it being turned into a fairy tale is so fascinating. It's been turned into like a, you know, this happened in the early 20th century. So an early 20th century fairy tale,
yeah.
Right?
Right,
yeah.
Right. And like a fairy tale, which can be very descriptive of a psychological or soulful truth, if you look past the obvious imagery within it. So too, like when you describe like the kind of storytelling that goes around, like, oh, it's cursed, you shouldn't open it because bad things will happen. Yeah, bad things will happen to your psyche if you desecrate graves and treat other human beings like they're less than you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
That all of that was stuff that like I wanted to explore in my book, which was this notion of the parallel story of that kind of what we were just talking about. But also it's like, how is it damaging to us when we exotify others? It's damaging to them for sure, but it also does something bad to us because it's making the world smaller. It's literally making the world a smaller place for us. And that, and so it's actually mutually beneficial to
treat
people like humans. Because it's something that like has been important to me for a long time in my work. It's like, I want my work to support and put forward my personal beliefs, but I don't want to wag my finger at anybody because I don't think that that's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, but I want to, before we get any further into this bit of the weeds in terms of like the topics of cultural repatriation, I want to talk a little bit more about your interests, because another thing that where the Venn diagram between the two of us is very, it's very, very covered, is you are not just into this stuff, but you like, if I get you going on Godzilla, I'm going to be in trouble. Because
that could be a whole separate podcast.
I remember going to see, which Godzilla movie was it we went to see in the theater?
Godzilla King of the Monsters.
That's right, which was great.
Yes.
I loved it.
It was amazing. Oh, and one of the best of the current Godzilla iterations, I think.
And I remember us in the car afterwards, and it was like there was no air because we were talking about it so much. And like how beautiful Mothra was in the movie.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And that lovely scene.
Truly, there were just beautiful vignettes in that film of the monsters interacting together. I bought the art book, you know. I look at it all the time.
So, but then also, it's like, so this, it's, I'm just trying to like give like a little like a survey of Marisa's quirks, because you're also really into cryptids, which I'm into.
I am, yes. Oh, Mothman is my favorite. I love Mothman.
Why Mothman?
Oh, that's a really good question. I've always loved the Loch Ness Monster, but I've never been to Scotland yet. But I have been to Point Pleasant, which is in Ohio. And I think that was the first time that I was able to be in the same place that there were cryptid sightings, you know, in the 60s. And then over the years, Mothman's been spotted in other places around the country, but that is, you know, the first place that Mothman appeared. And I remember being, because I went as a kid, I was, you know, 11, I think. And I remember thinking that was just so cool that I was standing in the same town that Mothman appeared. Mm-hmm. And there were all these people, these old people, and because we went to the cafe in Point Pleasant to have coffee, and there were people who were in their 80s remembered seeing Mothman, and they talked about it. And I was like, well, this is like a collective memory. This is so cool. There's just all these old people sitting around talking about, you know, remember when the bridge collapsed and Mothman was there? Of course, everybody knows that, you know. And I don't know, it just captured my imagination in a really specific way. The idea that there could be this sort of like secret world of animals that we don't really know about, but that appear every now and then to, you know, to say hi or to shake hands with us, and then they go back away again. I always thought that was really awesome.
So there's an element of, I'm going to say back in my own words, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, like an element of magical realism to it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say 100%. I've never thought of it in that way, but that's true. It's real life magical realism, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, these are both areas where like I grew up, I loved kaiju movies growing up, and I also was really into anything that was in like the periphery of the cryptid world, right? Like the Bigfoot stories, like Leonard Nimoy's TV show In Search Of from the 1970s.
Oh, that one's great. Oh, it's amazing.
And there was something about it being just scary enough, but also irresistible enough. Like, I knew I was going to be scared if I read more, but I had to read more. And I remember, like, as a young boy, like, checking out any book I could find in my school library around these topics of, like, alien sightings, cryptids, Bigfoots, Loch Ness Monster, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's something about those, our shared interest on that, that informed this book, too, because there's something about, because when you think about, you know way more about Mothman than me, but, like, if I were to characterize what I find compelling about the whole idea of cryptids, is it's the conflicting information and it's the lack of real provenance, right? It's like you've got eyewitness testimony and then you've got like a little bit of like circumstantial evidence, but you don't have like really authoritative academic evidence of any of these things.
And there are people who are emotional and under a lot of stress too in some cases. So
say
that
more.
When the first Mothman sighting, I think in Point Pleasant, happened late at night, it was four teenagers in a car, and they were being chased by Mothman. They saw his glowing red eyes and his, you know, big 7-foot wingspan, and they were being chased by him. And so when they got back into town, out of the woods, and Mothman wasn't there anymore, and they were trying to tell people what happened to them, it got published in the paper and kind of sensationalized, but people were pretty dismissive of them because, oh, they mistook what they were seeing and everybody was kind of hysterical. And well, these were, I mean, they were kids and they were scared. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that also can affect, I think, people's perception of the story you're telling or how reliable, right, the narrative is. When it was clear that whatever had happened, they went through a really emotional experience. And that affected them, you know, deeply.
So another theme that I'm picking up on in this, just this little short conversation we've had so far, is there's an element of listening. When you're talking about like dealing with cultural objects and heritage, there's an element of listening to the people who are directly connected to it, but then also treating treating the object, the people who would have interacted with this object, as humans, and trying to listen with an unbiased ear to what their story is. But yes, also in this element of cryptids.
Very, very true.
Yeah. It's it's like you're identifying the fact that, well, the kids were scared. So rather than dismiss, let's maybe not believe them outright, but at least try to get under the hood of what happened to like make somebody feel that kind of terror, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that's like a real human way to interact with humans.
It is. No, it really is.
But it's just, I feel like there's something about this time that we're in where I feel like the pendulum is starting to shift, but I feel like we've been in a long period of time where we really want to cast everybody in a narrow lens, right? Like our instinct is to go for that. And so,
well, that's sort of like the whole history of museums, my field. That's what it's built on, you know, is looking at people through a very narrow lens based on the cultural heritage items that have come into people's possession one way or another, whether that was through legal means or more often illegal means. That's the reality of it, that museums are built on these cultural misrepresentations and cultural misappropriations. And the field is now starting within just the last, I would say, 10 years, but within the last 5 years has really, really been grappling with that, with that problem.
I feel like this is a story that doesn't get told as broadly as I would like to hear. Because when I hear people get a little bit snooty or a little bit smug about people doing land acknowledgments and how, you know, like that's performative, it doesn't really help anybody, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, okay, but slow your roll. that's one thing you're seeing of a larger mm-hmm. network of systemic approaches to dismantle and subvert a lot of assumptions that were going on for a long time, right?
Right. Right. So. It's a lot of the work is behind the scenes because this isn't necessarily work for the public to know about. It's can be very intimate between the institution and the source communities that are reclaiming their heritage and their history and their emotions. It's emotional work. I mean, I've had some very personally extremely emotional experiences working with communities, and it's hard. It's really hard to build that trust when it's been, you know, obliterated, right?
Yeah.
And there is no reason that communities should trust institutions, because they were the ones actively, you know, inflicting cultural genocide, right? Like that was what was going on, especially in the United States, North America, in really any part of the Americas. So it's heavy stuff.
No, I mean, I in my own way, the way I encounter this is when I'm working with schools in underprivileged areas where and I'm watching a whole nother kind of cultural assumptions going into some of these spaces where, you know, like you'll hear people talk about the school to prison system in some, you know, poor neighborhoods, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get into some of these schools and I'll be like, oh, yeah, I see it. And that this is not good. And I'm not so sure how much I can do. And then also that building of trust with the student body, not trivial, right?
Right.
So...
Right. And it takes a long time, you know,
to
build trust. And it has to be sincere. People know when it's not, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah. People are a lot smarter than we think people are in a general sense. And I think like going in with a belief in people is like part of that framework, too.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe in people or not? But the reason I wanted to go into this is like I feel like this topic is a big part of what I was trying to explore with Dr. Bear. Cause I didn't want to just go into the whole, like, okay, bad things happen. And then somebody sets it right. It's like, no, because like a big part of it when you're confronted with those assumptions is a lot of negative feelings. You feel shame,
right?
You feel a little bit dumb because like, oh my gosh, it was right in front of me this whole time. And I never noticed it because it was the air I was breathing. And then you feel like, okay, well now I'm powerless because like, it's so big. There's nothing I can do that wouldn't be just pure performance, right?
Right.
So I wanted my hero to, and for people who are reading the book, the reason I'm bringing this up is I hope you'll pick up on this in there. Like there's a real dark moment for poor Dr. Bear where he has to be confronted with a lot of this kind of reality. And what do you do with that, right? Mm-hmm. And
well, I do think you communicated the emotionality of it really clearly in the book, you know, because I was one of the early readers. And there were parts where I cried.
Yeah.
I felt like my own personal experience was really seen in the way that
really?
He reacted. Yeah, truly. And it is hard to communicate to people, I think, this part of my job, because it is what I'm doing isn't about me at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's about getting justice for the people who are, you know, really hurting by not having their cultural heritage, and they're returning their lives to them in a big way, you know. But it's hard work for the people doing it. And I think you do have to look inward and say, what are the biases and assumptions and things that I personally have done, and how do I correct those in myself in order to move forward to do this work?
I remember years ago there was a Star Wars exhibit at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And,
oh yes, Star Wars.
and I was there with my wife Anne. We were doing, I think, a comics workshop at the DIA, and but like part of our day was going through the exhibit, and I remember turning a corner into this one room where they had the Tusken Raiders set up, those creatures who live on Tatooine, who wear all the brown robes.
Oh, yes.
And talk with those weird barking noises. And yep. The moment I hit that room, I was like, oh my God, I just realized that, like, my whole life, I'm looking 50 in the face, Barissa. My whole life, I had been living under this cloud of, oh, Tusken Raiders, they're just like those weird savage creatures who live out in the Jungian wastes, mm-hmm. right? And I'm like, right. Oh my God, they lifted so many different cultural
appropriations.
Yes. And
yeah.
then like made it into the weird fetishized demon monster.
it's a different experience encountering that in a museum setting,
yeah.
right? When you're watching the movie, it does sort of go over your head because it's with a lot of other,
yeah.
you know, really exciting visuals, and you're invested in Luke's story. You're not necessarily thinking about the periphery,
sure,
right? But when you're confronted with it in a museum, it sort of like recontextualizes it into yeah. that cultural framework, right? Where yeah. you can say, oh, wait a minute.
Right.
I see what's going on now. But also, you know, you don't necessarily come from one of those cultures where those things were appropriated from,
sure.
right? Those visual cues. So it also, you know, it might have gone completely over your head, but someone else watching the movie might be like, wait a minute.
Yeah. Yeah,
I know what's going on here, and they can have a completely different viewing experience, right? Because mm-hmm. of that.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's like, this is something that really changed for me in the last like 15 years. Is like when those moments happen, I literally feel like the world gets bigger. Like it's shocking, and there's like a moment of like real like kind of like introspection and taking stock that happens, it, like in this flash of like a lot of hot emotions. And then it's mm-hmm. like, oh, wow, there's a lot of things that I didn't see that now I see. And like that's, I think that's something that a feeling that I'm trying to do in my art is try mm-hmm. to like make that available to people in a way that isn't. And that's why I don't like to wag a finger, because I think wag a finger makes people feel smaller, whereas like inviting in makes people feel
right.
like the world is bigger. But that
when
was...
it doesn't help to get the work done, you know, if you're telling people this was.
Yeah.
Well, you really screwed up here.
Well, okay, so now let's shift gears into like lean hard into the topic of object and cultural repatriation, because I will tell mm-hmm. you, when I was on the road promoting the book to librarians, whenever I brought up that topic, I would get a flash of, oh, like there's a real like moment where people like really mm-hmm. opened up to that notion of like, oh, it's lighthearted fantasy that gently approaches this idea of like, what do you do about the fact that. And I remember it was through my conversations mm-hmm. with you and my wife Anne when I was like, oh yeah, those obelisks in Europe got there probably not by the best means, and
right,
right, like, and
yep.
and
yeah,
and then now, so this is where I'm really stepping into your house, and I want to be respectful of this, and I don't want to necessarily play devil's advocate and like push and like get you to defend your position on this, but I do mm-hmm. want to like address this from the standpoint of like where I was when I was first engaging with this topic.
Mm-hmm.
Is
yeah.
I remember hearing the argument that, hey, museums safeguard, we keep this stuff safe mm-hmm. and accessible. Mm-hmm. to the public. That's a service. That is a good that's rendered. And I was like, okay, yes. But this,
yeah.
that's not the whole story, right?
No, it's not. And I think that idea of like benign stewardship, you know, like, oh, we're not doing anything wrong here. We're just keeping these objects. We're keeping them safe. They're not going to get damaged. They're not going to get broken, we're treating them really respectfully, you know, everything's going to be fine, is a way to delegitimize the ownership of the people that these, you know, objects came from. That like, oh, they could not possibly know how to take care of these objects.
At the very least, that's
museum
implicit, right?
Can take care of these objects.
Yeah.
And that has been, you know, sort of an excuse that has been used in the museum field for a really long time to like justify why these objects were still being held, even when communities had the ability to come forward and say, oh, we want these back. This was, we know this was stolen. We know that this was taken from a battlefield. We know that this was acquired through deception. We know that somebody smuggled this out in their suitcase. Like, we know, we have names, we know who did it. And that would be a way, you know, institutions would be like, oh, you can come in and see it anytime. Why do we need to give it back? Well, the actual act of giving it back, and that's righting the actual wrong, is returning it so that it can, that that object can live in the community that it came from and that the community can use it however they want. And in some ways, I think museums were, you know, hiding behind that and actively causing, I mean, they were actively causing harm, period. You know, this means a lot to people. It's not academic. I think, you know, treating it as benign stewardship, the museum field wants people to think that's what it is, but it's creating harm.
Well,
active harm.
The thing that, as we had conversations around this, I think that the thing that became the most fascinating to me was, what if they mean it? What if they're telling the truth that from their standpoint, that's what they think they're doing? And how do you get them to come around to realizing that even if you think you're doing good, sometimes you're not doing good, right? It's like, I've been married for going on 25 years, and I can tell you there are a lot of times when I said in a fit of fury in a fight with my partner, I would say, well, I didn't mean you to feel that way. It's like, yeah. That doesn't matter right now. What matters is the way I'm feeling about it right now.
Right. Yes, exactly. I've heard a lot of, you know, people will say things like, well, this happened 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, it had nothing to do with me, or it had nothing to do with us. Why should we care? Or why should we work towards fixing it? And it's, you know, I was not born in the 1920s when some of our problematic objects came into the museum, right?
Yeah, right, yes.
But I am in the position where I can not entirely fix the wrongs that were done, but I can acknowledge them and say, this was wrong. What can I do to help fix it? And I think acknowledging that it's wrong, and then you're going to move forward from it, you're not forgetting that happened. And you always have to acknowledge people's pain. But the way to move forward is to say, you know, very openly and honestly, we will do whatever you need us to do to make it right. And if that means giving it back so that it goes home to the people who really own it, then it goes back. And if that means the museum has to keep it, but store it in a certain way that the community wants, then that's what the museum does. And if that means, you know, there's other options that the community wants, then you do those things. But it really is saying it's not about me, it's about you.
I think there's also an element in what you're describing too about not applying your prescription to problem solving. Something that I run into as a teaching artist is I work with a lot of different kinds of teachers, and I notice there's a certain kind who's really kind of they like power. And even if that manifests in them just wanting control of a room, at the heart of it is like a fascination with them being the most powerful person in the room. My attitude is, by dint of the fact that I'm the adult, I already am. So I don't need to, wrestle for it. I don't need to fight for it. And as a matter of fact, I don't know what anybody in this room needs until I meet them. And so there's teachers who come in with a lesson plan of, this is what we're going to do. Everybody needs to get on board. Everybody needs to sit in rows. Look at me.
Yep.
I've got the thing we're doing today. And then when I come in, I'm a disruptive element because I'll look each and every kid in the eye and I'll slow the room down and say, like, hey, I thought we were doing this, but if your heart is someplace else, let's figure out where that is. And then we'll do that. Right. Which doesn't look like control. And to some people that doesn't look like power, but to me, there's an element, and this is a very important part. I would say this is like kind of central to my philosophy as a human being, is like power is meant to be shared. And that's the only proper use of it. The only proper use of it is to give it to other, like to distribute it so that everybody has some and not try to wield it on your own, because I only have a tiny.
I agree with that.
So
yeah,
that's what I'm hearing in what you're describing as well, is this idea of it's not capitulation. It's somehow inviting to, it's inviting in and saying we all have a stake. Let's all have a stake. Not I have the prescription. I know you're hurting. Here, I'll fix it. Just shut up and let me fix it.
I wish it could be, you know, that easy in a way, but it's so not. right.
Yeah. Like there's it, these two chapters of the book where Dr. Bear is like yelling at the spirit, saying like, no. I got your story. It's in my book. I wrote it. You seem to be telling me something else. It's not something else. I've got it. I've got the providence. Right. So,
right.
Which is
you have to throw all that out. You have to say, I know nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and I need to learn. I need to be the one that's learning. And I think that was communicated really well in your book. Dr. Bear learns it, you know.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Well, no, I mean, I use that book metaphor pretty straightforward, where he actually says, like in chapter 5 or whatever, he's like, look, oh, I lost my book. Well, I can't use that anyway. It's full of lies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the difficult thing about navigating this topic, I think, thoughtfully, is we have a lot of baggage around some of the terminology that you and I have been using today. Like when you say, like, you have to admit that I know nothing. Now, when I hear that, the word that conjures in my head is freedom. Oh, that means the world just got bigger. I'm about to learn a whole bunch of really cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for somebody who's traditionally educated in the West, where you're tested for state standards to see if you know the right thing so we can beat the other countries, right?
Yeah.
Saying you know nothing that's a shameful act. That is admitting that you are weak and you might as well give up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
And it's showing vulnerability.
Well, yeah.
You know, that too. People are so uncomfortable being vulnerable.
That's true.
And saying, I don't know. Please teach me, or please help me learn.
Yeah.
Asking for help is really hard too. When you don't know what to do and you don't want to admit you don't know what to do, asking for help can be really difficult.
Yeah. No, that's no joke. That's no joke. And again, I think there's a lot of cultural baggage in the West around that as well. The self-made business person, right? Pulled myself up by my bootstraps. I did it all myself.
I hate that. I hate the bootstrap thing.
I forget who was talking about it, but you can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right?
No, you can't. It doesn't work.
That's where the
expression comes from. Physically, it doesn't work.
Oh, and I think that's another element of this that, like, was important to me as a human and important to me as an author, is like there's a note of interdependency in this topic, is that we actually need each other, and it goes both ways, which means we all have to show up for each other, which sounds really like a platitude. It feels like it's like, you know, I don't know, like a Hallmark card or something, but encoded in that is something really rich. So, like, if I could just dig a little bit more into this idea of repatriation. I'm hoping you could say a few words about like the access, because like it is like a objective good that providing access to things like public libraries, awesome, the best, right?
Oh,
why?
Yeah.
Free access libraries to information. So like what's the difference then when it comes to like providing wider access? Like you might get somebody who will have that moment like I had with the Tuscan Raiders, where suddenly the world gets bigger because I see it in a new context.
Right. There are so many ways that can be done by letting contemporary people tell their stories without any interpretation by an institution, for example. And in that aspect of it, remembering that a lot of what we see in museums comes from communities that are living nowadays.
Yeah.
It isn't as if, for example, the ancient Egyptians, like Egyptians, don't exist anymore. There's a whole country full of people who are living their lives and have their own stories to tell.
Right, right.
You know,
again,
and
I'm not laughing in the good way, Marisa.
No. And it's so important to let people tell their own stories without any overbearing, right? Mm. From sort of a larger institution that says, I know exactly how to tell this. Yeah. And I remember I was in Egypt in 2020, really early in 2020, like right before the pandemic happened. I was really lucky to get to go. And we went to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, the original museum, because there's a new one now that was built. But this original one was built actually by a French man, and he's buried on the site, which was very interesting. And problematic. But so I was in the museum, and it was a weekday, and there were so many school kids there. And they were sitting around statues, and their teachers were telling them about whatever pharaoh they were looking at. There were children sketching in the galleries. Kids were running around and excited about, like, oh, come look at this. You know, I saw this really cool thing over here. And I had such an emotional moment. I was sitting there going, this is why we have to give stuff back. Mm. So that these kids can learn about their own history with their own cultural objects in their own country. Why should they come to the United States to see something when they can have it in their own backyard? That's where it belongs. It belongs to them, you know? And I was really moved by that. That was so much more spectacular to me than any of the spectacular things I saw in the museum, was having that moment where I was like, this is why we have to do the work that we do. It's so important for the next generation, for these kids. And to see how much fun they were having. Oh, they were so excited. You know, more people should get to run around museums screaming about how excited they are to see stuff.
I'm with you.
It was
on that
chaos one. And it was wonderful, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. Like, yeah, I've actually had conversations with well-meaning adults. I'll offer them that. I'll say, maybe you mean well, and they'll say, oh, these kids, they don't know how to be in a museum. I'm like, well,
oh, I know.
Do they or don't they? I mean, like, and also, it's like, would it be the worst?
Are we the ones doing it wrong?
It could be. It could very well be, right? It's like, but then again, like I have to caveat that with the fact that I describe my classroom management style as the knife's edge of Lord of the Flies. Like, if you walked in on my classroom, it would almost look like, is somebody going to get hurt? Is the adult in control or not, right? And it's like, it's a very nice, thin place to exist where it's like, they're having a marvelous time, and I'm not trying to, like, I've got bumpers on the side of the lanes, but I'm not pushing anybody. I'm letting them bump into the wall on their own. But anyway, we should wrap pretty soon. But I do want to say I need to, like, publicly offer you, like, a really heartfelt thanks, Marisa, because I remember when I got the book contract, and I had, like, the bare bones of the concept figured out for the book, but I didn't have the outline written, all that. I had, like a third draft outline. I didn't have, like, a solid outline. But I knew that this concept of object and cultural repatriation was going to be a guiding theme in the book. It was going to guide, like, the character growth. It was going to guide the plot, et cetera. And I said, Marisa, can I please talk with you on the phone for an hour? And you made the time to sit down and just counsel me on this topic. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. I remember that was such a fun conversation.
It was the sweetest thing because you were so generous with your time and with your expertise and with, like, allowing me to be the big dumb Westerner who stomps into spaces. And, like, you weren't being judged about it, because I was giving you all the devil's advocate. I'm like, but this, but that, but this, I don't get it. And you were very, like, very patient with me and helping me, like, sort of come to, the realization that, oh, no, what you're describing here is a very gentle, very, this was a very kind comment somebody gave about my book when at ALA. Somebody said, this book is an antidote to toxic masculinity. I'm like, wow.
Like, oh, what? Yeah.
What a thing to hear, right? I mean, that feels grandiose, but I'll take it. And I feel like
I hope it's going on the blurbs in the back as a quote.
But the point too is, like, what I think you were helping me sort of come to with that conversation was this idea of, I'm not trying to punish you. I'm trying to help you understand that there's a more caring way to do this. And that's, and like, mm-hmm. I really felt like you invited me in, and you really, you had a profound impact on how this book shaped out. So that's kind of the reason I wanted to, like, you know.
Well, thank you, Jersey. That's so nice. That's so wonderful to say. I had so much fun talking with you and in the subsequent conversations that we had as the book evolved and the story progressed. And I really enjoyed being a beta reader. That was so much fun. And I've loved seeing how the story has turned out. I've gotten really, you know, invested in the characters that you created.
Well, that's kind
I can't wait to see what adventures they come up with next, you know. So, but you were a great listener. I mean, and that also, you came to our discussions with a really open mind. You asked really good questions. Mm. And I think you weren't afraid to engage with things that you didn't understand or didn't feel comfortable completely with. And I think it takes a really open heart to have that, to come to that and say, you know, I just want to, like, I'm going to ask stupid questions, but please teach me, you know?
Well, yeah. And
that... And you didn't ask any stupid questions. Actually, I don't remember any stupid ones.
Yeah, but like going back to what you're talking about like sometimes this labor is very emotionally expensive. It's like, yeah, this was, and I've said this 100 times in my little microcast, but like it was such a transformative experience in making the book that it almost doesn't matter if anybody buys it, because like I got something so good, so big out of the journey through it. I mean, mm-hmm. I still want lots of people to buy it. I want like tens and thousands of people to buy it.
Everybody should buy this book, honestly.
But if they don't, it's like I still have this marvelous, rich experience of the going through it and making it, which was like really, really awesome. And again, I mean, I think having somebody like you to turn to who will give me these awesome lists of cursed object ideas, who could get into the nerdy weeds of like cryptid, you know, trivia, but then also get into like the more heavy philosophical areas around like, well, what does it mean like to be a good human and being a steward mm-hmm. of the world? So.
So well, I think reason. what you just said is all about collaboration, right?
Yeah.
And working with people, you know. Dr. Bear has his group that he's working with to like nobody goes through a repatriation process alone. You're always doing it as a group, as a team, and you have to support each other. And sometimes that's, you know, showing up. And sometimes that's real emotional, you know, emotional digging. And, you know, sometimes that's having hard conversations with people, whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that, what you wrote really captured that spirit of collaboration and self-reflection and letting people tell their own stories in the way that they need to tell them, you know.
That's awesome. Thank you for that. I feel very validated by that. Whew, I needed to hear it. Okay, thank you. Marisa,
you're very welcome.
Thank you for spending this time with me to record this is the kickoff to the book being in the world. It means a lot.
Well, thank you for inviting me to have this conversation with you. I was so excited when you asked me to do this, and it's been so much fun. I hope we can keep talking about these things.
Me too.
Once again, I have to thank my friend Marisa, not only for believing in the book from the start and lending so much of her time to help me sort through a large web of ideas that were kind of tumbling around in my brain as I began, but also coming back to, you know, high-five me with this conversation. So once again, the book is out now. It's at drbaer.com, drbaer.com. You can find it on all bookstore websites. You can find it at independent bookstores, your local comic store. It's a 248-page full-color graphic novel. I really hope you enjoy it. Okay, so I'll be back soon with another Thunder Punch Daily, and until then, remember, everybody.
Today, He-Man had to decide whether or not to chop down a tree. Now, the trees around you probably don't speak the way Sky Tree did. Or if they do, we haven't learned to hear them yet. But trees are living things. And when you respect a tree, you show that you care about all life. Life is a wonderful, precious gift. Learn to enjoy and respect it, and you'll be a happier, better person for it. Bye for now.